It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a newly discovered rock that's over 4 billion years old. A UW geoscientist is part of the team that found this ancient rock, and he'll talk about how it could be evidence of how the Earth formed.
But first, news broke late yesterday that childhood obesity rates have declined significantly in the last decade.
According to a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, researchers saw a 43% drop in obesity rates in kids aged 2 to 5.
New science shows a large part of a child's obesity risk is already determined by the age of 5, so this could be big news in the struggle to keep Americans at a healthy weight.
An expert on childhood obesity rates is here to break down these numbers and what could have caused the decline. Tracy Flood is with us. She's Population Health Fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Tracy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been a fan of NPR for a long time, so it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, that's great to hear. Well, this new study, a 43% drop in obesity among this age range, 2 to 5, looked like a big deal to us. Is this a big deal?
It certainly is a striking number, and myself and other physicians at the UW have been talking about it a lot and wondering if we can trust these numbers, sort of this idea that it's too good to be true. And I think it does really provide a very optimistic picture about what is happening in the fight against childhood obesity.
I don't want to step on the optimism right out of the gate here, but this is just one group, right? It doesn't mean we can give up on obesity efforts, does it?
No, of course not. So any one study does need to be interpreted with caution. Other studies have really been showing very, very similar things. A study out of Ohio, Massachusetts, and the CDC actually studied low-income preschoolers. They've all found the same things that were turning the tide on childhood obesity. It may be too soon to tell if these changes are sustainable, but they're all very consistent with one another.
Well, I imagine the big question that people in your line of work are asking is why? Why are we seeing these declines? What are some of the options people are throwing out there?
So there's been a few things thrown out there. In any the development of any obesity state, there's a lot of different factors that play in. And for young children in particular, it really attributed increases in breastfeeding, for instance. An increase in awareness of the issue has probably changed a lot of parental behaviors. We know, for instance, that preschoolers mirror their parents in almost every single way. And so when a parent decides to be healthier as a family, the preschoolers really do take on those new habits and mimic them and can alter their lifelong food habits.
Well, that's interesting. So one of the best interventions for kids might be to get parents to change their behavior.
That's definitely true. And we have seen a lot of great policy changes for early child care centers. But also, I do think a very large part of it is families. Some of the major risk factors for preschool obesity occur in the home, like TV watching, sugar-sweetened beverage intake, and not eating family meals together. And so my hypothesis, although we still need more information, is that a lot of these changes have happened at home.
As we mentioned right at the outset, there's science, some new science, I think, showing that a child's obesity risk is really set by the age of 5 or heavily established. Does that mean these numbers bode well for the future? As this cohort of kids get older, can we expect them to stay away from obesity?
I think that's certainly true. Even outside of the home, policy and environmental changes are really shaping the places their children grow up in. And especially for a child entering kindergarten, at a normal weight is very, very low risk for developing obesity later on. Kindergartens who are overweight or obese are at an increased risk of continued weight gain, probably because they've established habits early on that are then carried forward.
You mentioned environment for kids, and one argument you hear is, oh, kids aren't active enough, they're not getting enough exercise. And one response I've seen from the public health community is, well, if a kid doesn't have a safe place to play, safe streets to walk on, there's crime in the neighborhood, that's going to prevent them from getting out and getting active. How important a factor are those kind of outside environmental issues?
Oh, they're incredibly important. Children in general are exquisitely sensitive to the world around them. So they're watching parents for cues and behavior, but they're also looking at their environment, and having safe streets, having safe places to play, having just a place to go outside, is very important, especially actually after the age of preschool when children are more out and about and on their own. In preschool, it's really just about having enough space to run around.
A few years back, First Lady Michelle Obama announced a Let's Move campaign against childhood obesity. How important is something like that, a priority setting from at the federal level?
Priority setting at the federal level is absolutely pivotal, more so that it creates a cultural shift and expectation. And so we're seeing a lot of policies, environmental change, and even individual behaviors follow with that great leadership. I know that there's been concern about the government stepping in that sense, but Michelle Obama has really been a tremendous advocate for this issue.
And also a lot of the impetus coming from the federal level, some local efforts, changes to regulations of school meals, what is served to kids. We're going through a lot of different factors here. How important is that, what kids eat at school?
Well, of course, that's very important. Children eat a lot of foods, a lot of meals at school. Now, for the change that we're seeing in the preschool age range, it probably is less to do with the school meals because those are obviously in children that are over the age of five. But in general, because it takes so long for children to learn to like fruits and vegetables in particular, then any exposure that they get to those healthy foods, whether in school or preschool, is really beneficial.
And speaking of healthy foods, the USDA, I think it was a couple years back, got rid of the old food pyramid that I used to learn in school. They replaced it with My Plate. It says fill half your plate with fruits and vegetables and other guidelines. I remember we did a show on the Ideas Network that came out, and a lot of people expressed skepticism that anybody paid attention to the food pyramid in the first place or then would pay attention to the new My Plate. Is that just a lot of empty paperwork, or again, is that setting that cultural tone for us?
I actually really love the My Plate method.
You do?
I'm
okay.
A physician who now works in public health, but when I saw patients, I loved talking to them about the plate method. Just because it's very, very simple. Half of everything we eat should be a fruit or a vegetable. And so if you look down at your plate and you don't see that half of the foods are coming from something resembling a source like Mother Nature, then you're probably not eating correctly according to the USDA recommendations.
We're talking to Tracy.
So I actually really love that method.
Right. We'll pick up the conversation in just a few. We're talking with Tracy Flood, Population Health Fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She studies childhood obesity, talking about the news, surprising news to me anyway. Childhood obesity declined 43%, according to the CDC, among kids aged 2 to 5. We want to hear from you. Are you surprised to hear this, too? Do you think we're doing the right things to fight childhood obesity in kids? What more do you think we should be doing? And what do you do to keep your own family healthy? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We're talking now with Dr. Tracy Flood, Population Health Fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She studies childhood obesity.
We're talking about new research showing a big drop in obesity numbers for kids aged 2 to 5. You can join the conversation with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you think we're doing the right things in terms of public health, fighting obesity in kids? What changes would you like to see? What do you do in your own family? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Flood, we've seen improvements in this one age group, at least according to this study. Now, what about the rest of us? What can we do to extend those benefits to the whole rest of the population?
Well, first of all, this age group is very, very special. I really want to point that out because we are seeing changes mostly in this age group, studies across the entire United States. This age group is very, very special because preschool is a time when lifelong food habits are being formed and also before fat cells are being made. And so you really have to appreciate that biologically, this is a truly pivotal moment. And if we want these changes to be carried forward, then we need to make sure that these children grow up and continue to stay a healthy weight. And I think they'll grow up to be normal weight adults.
Are there other things that we're not doing as a society, maybe as a state, that you, as someone who researches these issues, would like to see happen? What aren't we doing that you'd like to see us do?
You know, I've actually, the opposite is actually true in that I've been very, very overwhelmed with how on board everyone is with this issue. I've been incredibly surprised at the support that this effort has received in the community. There's coalitions in every single county of Wisconsin that are doing work in early child care and, you know, putting in parks and bike trails. So first, before I say what we can improve upon, I really have to say it's been overwhelming how much people have rallied around this issue. And I think you can see it's reflected in the numbers there. Now, the place where I feel like we're not necessarily focusing is in getting a TV out of the child's bedroom. And that's really something that policy can't touch. It has to be something that happens in the home. But it's still a practice that puts children at risk of future obesity. The other thing that I've seen positive changes on, but I still think more can be done, is advertising unhealthy foods to children. And the reason for that is manyfold, mostly because children have to learn to trust healthy foods, and they learn to trust the foods that they see very, very often. And so when they see advertisements for unhealthy foods, it's really reinforcing those food preferences. And this has a very negative impact because preschoolers are naturally very picky eaters. And so when they see the foods over and over and over again that their parents don't necessarily want to buy, then they actually pester the parents for those foods. And so even very, very well-meaning and health-conscious parents can find themselves at the mercy of this pester power that actually originates from unhealthy food advertisements.
Well, it sounds like that TV in the bedroom is a double whammy then. I mean, you get a more sedentary lifestyle with the TV there, and the kids are probably seeing ads for the foods you're talking about.
That is absolutely true. And the third whammy, of course, is that the child is less likely to sleep well, which is also associated with obesity. So it's a triple whammy.
And TVs, you mentioned. How about in an age of high-tech computers, tablets, phones in the bedroom? Is there research looking at that yet, or do we just have that research on TVs because they've been around for so long?
You know, I would say we have better research because it's been around for so long. I would say that any media that encourages completely relaxed and sedentary behavior is probably going to have the same effect. And anything that disrupts sleep or promotes unhealthy foods without the parents' knowledge will have a similar effect. Now, having said that, we haven't seen the same associations with video games or reading books, for instance.
And is there technology on the other end of the spectrum? Can we harness technology to encourage exercise and good diet? We've seen fitness apps, at least for grown-ups. There are exercise-y video games. Is there promise there?
So if it's between a very sedentary video game and an active video game, I would choose the active video game. But there is really no substitute for just nature. Children are very, very active in nature. Now, in regards to promoting healthy foods, technology can definitely help there. You can imagine that just as unhealthy foods can be advertised, healthy foods can also be advertised and really help parents with those efforts to encourage fruits and vegetables, and particularly vegetables.
There's been criticism lately of the food industry for the kind of foods that are marketed and sold having too much sugar, too much fat, too much salt, other things that might be connected to bad health and in many cases obesity. Are you seeing changes in the food industry as well, especially when it comes to kids' food?
So there has been a voluntary movement of a lot of food companies to stop advertising to very young children. Now, I will say that no one food has been demonized. No one's pointing a finger at pizza or hamburgers for children's health. In fact, in children, the most important thing, well, there's two important things. The first is beverages, having healthy beverages like milk and water. And the other is eating meals as a family. So while advertisements can certainly shape a child's food preferences later in life, their immediate risk of obesity comes when families don't eat meals together. And that's really what we're seeing.
I wanted to spend a little time on consequences here. If the obesity levels go back up, we don't get them back down even further, what's the long-term risk for individual kids and for our society as a whole of obesity?
So for individual kids, if you're entering kindergarten, overweight or obese, really you have a very, very high chance of continuing to gain weight and becoming an overweight or obese, an even obese adult. Now, if you enter the teenage years overweight or obese, that is associated with 3 times the risk of dying before the age of 55 from cardiovascular disease and other related diseases. So even in the early ages, we would say these children are quite young, but they still have the beginnings of this early risk of later disease and early death down the road. And so I would definitely say that while this is very, very promising, we have to make sure that children get to adulthood at a normal, healthy weight or with an active lifestyle.
Dr. Flood, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Tracy Flood, Population Health Fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She studies childhood obesity.
A big discovery hit the news in the last week. A fragment of rock, a zircon, clocking in at 4.4 billion years old, was found in Australia. And scientists say it gives us insight into the early development of our planet.
The scientist who led the effort behind the discovery is in the studio now. John Valley is professor of geoscience at the UW-Madison. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here today, Rob.
Well, when we're talking about an item that's 4 billion years old, how do we measure something like that?
Well, geologists use a system called uranium-lead geochronology, and it's based on the natural radioactive decay of uranium to lead. We know the rate at which that occurs, and so we use this for minerals like zircon in particular, which form by concentrating uranium and with no lead. And so when we measure the ratio of lead to uranium, that tells us the age.
Now, I know this rock was found in Australia, but before we get to, you know, some of the things about what the discovery might mean, can you talk about how the rock was discovered and what zircon is?
Well, the place where it was discovered is a sheep station, a ranch of about 750,000 acres, a huge place. It's a very, very flat, very remote part of Australia. And we were working in the Jack Hills, which are a low ridge of hills that rise above this plain. And there are metamorphosed sandstones and conglomerates, which are rocks that might form on a beach or in a landslide sort of environment, sand and gravel that's been solidified. And literally some of the grains of sand on this beach were the mineral zircon. And the beach itself was formed 3 billion years ago, and some of the grains of sand were as much as 1.4 billion years old on that day.
Wow. So how, as you're sifting through this, how do you pick out the bits that might be the earliest materials we can find, these almost four and a half billion-year-old fragments?
Well, it takes a lot of perseverance. Zircon's actually quite a common mineral on the Earth's crust, but it's always a trace mineral. And so most igneous rocks that form from a magma, contain zircons. And so you crush up these rocks, and typically the zircons are one part in 1,000, one part in 10,000 of the rock. But by the time you've crushed up 100 kilograms of rock, you might have 1 million zircons. So then the trick is to figure out which ones are old. And we do this by dating, by the uranium lead method, using an instrument called an ion microprobe.
So all this time I've been picturing a rock about the size of a baseball that you could toss in your hand, and you're talking about a tiny fragment of a rock.
It's not even a big grain of sand. It's a small grain of sand. The crystal we reported this week is actually one of the largest zircons we've worked on. If it was in the palm of your hand, you probably wouldn't see it without a lens. It's twice the diameter of a human hair.
Wow.
And about the same length.
So you don't want to lose track of it.
Well, what we do is we embed them in epoxy. We cast them in epoxy in 1-inch round pucks, and then we polish into them.
So you've got this 4.4 billion-year-old grain of sand, grain of zircon here. What is that telling us now about the age of the Earth and how the Earth came to be what it is?
Well, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. So this represents a solid material that had formed within 100 million years of the formation and the birth of our planet. And previous to finding the first 4.4 billion years, zircon, which was actually 10 years ago when we first reported a crystal like this. This is the second one. Previous to finding these crystals, it was thought that there was no solid material preserved from this period on Earth, that the earliest Earth was what we call Hadean. The name of this period geologically is the Hadean Eon. And we had thought that the oldest rocks that are known are 4.0 billion years old. And we had thought that there was nothing that would be older. And so when we found these, that was quite a surprise.
So Earth was hot magma before this. These kind of findings tell us that it cooled off and solidified earlier than we previously thought. Am I hearing that right?
Yes. What we've done now is to verify the age. And now that we've verified the age of the zircon, it gives us greater confidence in other measurements we've made, one of which is the oxygen isotope ratio. And the oxygen isotopes are sensitive to temperature. And so by studying these old zircons, we know that as early as 4.3 billion years ago, the surface of the Earth had cooled sufficiently that the thick, heavy steam atmosphere that had existed earlier had condensed to form oceans. And once you have oceans on a planet, then it becomes habitable. So we have no direct evidence that there actually was life at 4.3 billion years ago, but there is no evidence that there wasn't. So it becomes a very interesting hypothesis. That compares to the oldest known microscopic fossils, that are 800 million years younger. So this really expands the period of time over which life might have emerged.
Now, some years back, you co-wrote an article called Zircons Are Forever. I love that title. Why can zircons last so long?
Well, it's a very hard mineral. It's very thermally resistant. It's chemically inert. They just tend to persist in the rock record for a long time. But actually, what we've done in this paper this week is to prove that this zircon really is forever. And when we published the first 4.4 billion year age in 2001, many people said, well, you know, maybe the lead moved around a little bit, and maybe the zircon wasn't really a closed system, which is an inherent assumption. And in science, nothing's ever accepted, especially if it's important. You have to prove it. And so what we've finally done, using a new technique called an atom probe, which is actually manufactured right here in Madison, Wisconsin by Cameco. Using this new technique, the atom probe, we've shown that the lead does move around, but it's by such little short distances that it has no effect on the geochronology, and the ages are correct.
I always wonder when thinking about astronomers and geologists who deal in these really long scales of time, you're thinking in billions of years. Does that change the way you think about time on a daily basis in your life?
I guess you have to abstract that a little bit. I certainly don't worry about billions of years when I look at my retirement fund.
Well, what's next for this piece of rock, and what will it mean when everything is corroborated?
Well, we're planning many other studies similar to this. I keep thinking every time we do something that we're done with the Jack Hill zircons, there's nothing possibly new that we can learn and keep being surprised. So I'm sure there will be new things with the Jack Hill zircons. But where we're going with the atom probe next is we're going to study zircons from the moon that were returned by the Apollo astronauts.
Oh, look forward to hearing about that. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us today. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
That was John Valley. He's professor of geoscience at the UW-Madison, talking about a 4.4 billion-year-old zircon. Their findings, his group's findings, are in the latest edition of the journal Geoscience.